22 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Live Your Dreams Party, Saturday, March 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Wayfinding Academy in Portland. Live Your Dreams Party is Wayfinding Academy's annual fundraiser. This year's theme is comfort. This event will provide a welcoming environment to kick back, relax, try something new, and learn more about the Academy's mission. Again, that's Live Your Dreams Party, Saturday, March 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Wayfinding Academy, 8010 North Charleston Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the coronavirus count is rising in the Pacific Northwest.
A bill to protect the confidentiality of unaccompanied minors has been introduced in the House and the Senate.
And in international news, the United States has bombed Afghanistan days after a peace agreement with the Taliban.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon.
And I'm Andrew Geller. This week, a racist threat prompted Portland police to patrol Grant High School. Asian students in several schools experienced discrimination recently due to the coronavirus pandemic, and a noose was found on the roof of Benson High School last week. These were just three of the racist incidents Portland Public Schools Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero spoke of during yesterday's school board meeting. He said these events were, quote, eerie, painful reminders of the acts of racial terror of our past and indicative of the racial injustice our students, families, and staff of color face today still, unquote. School officials have spent the last 4 months studying recurring racist patterns, leading some schools to begin working within their communities to address those issues.
The race for the Democratic nomination is still a tight one, but former Vice President Joe Biden got a huge boost after last night's Super Tuesday primary elections. Despite what was considered a failing campaign just a few days before, Biden went on to win 10 of the 14 states that ran their primaries last night. Senator Bernie Sanders still had a strong night with key wins in his home state of Vermont and in California, the state with the most delegates up for grabs. With more on Super Tuesday, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
This campaign will send Donald Trump packing. This campaign is taking off. Join us.
Former Vice President Joe Biden carried 8 states yesterday, Super Tuesday: Texas, North Carolina, Virginia, Massachusetts, Tennessee, Maine, Alabama, Arkansas, and even 2 states Senator Bernie Sanders took in 2016, Oklahoma and Minnesota. Sanders won California, the biggest delegate haul, Utah, Colorado, and his home state of Vermont.
We are not only taking on the corporate establishment, we're taking on the political establishment.
Alabama had tornado warnings and thunderstorms that cut off power at a handful of polling sites. In Tennessee, tornadoes in Nashville destroyed buildings and killed at least 22 people just hours before polls were set to open.
Polling places had to be changed because people had to be shifted around and whatnot.
Tennessee State University professor John Miglietta thinks the impact on turnout was minimal, in part because a lot of Tennesseans vote early.
So I don't think it had a huge effect on turnout. I mean, it may have impacted, you know, a couple of zip codes pretty thoroughly.
Former Mayor Mike Bloomberg's only win was the U.S. territory that voted yesterday, American Samoa. But despite $180 million towards Super Tuesday TV ads, the Bloomberg campaign is disappointed and plans to assess tomorrow whether there's a path forward. WRIR's Christopher Maxwell says Bloomberg's ground game was lacking.
He has got the best and some of the absolute most hilarious ads. But if you're not watching wherever he has purchased airtime, He's not texting. There's no yard signs. There's no door knocking. He doesn't exist outside of those ads.
Senator Elizabeth Warren's campaign also had a disappointing night. She came in third in her home state, Massachusetts, after Biden and Sanders. Massachusetts Democrat Lise King says some voters moved away from Warren, fearing a possible brokered convention.
It wasn't a lack of support for her. It was more of folks saying, I really think that our final goal needs to vote blue no matter who. We need someone who's going to beat Donald Trump.
Sanders, on the other hand, swept Vermont, his home state, with just over half the vote. Here's news nonprofit VT Diggers Colin Main.
You know, a lot of the sort of messages that made Bernie Sanders popular in Vermont have made him popular on the national stage.
Sanders' victory in California was based on his strength with Latino voters. But just like in South Carolina last week, major players in Biden's success were black voters in Virginia, North Carolina, Alabama, and Tennessee, according to Duke University's Professor DeAndre Rose.
As I look forward to post Super Tuesday, it will be really interesting, you know, if it comes down to a two-person race between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, especially in states like Florida and Georgia, I think the Latino vote will be especially important.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks to 2020 Talks intern Danny Gare, and thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Media attending Vice President Mike Pence's coronavirus briefing yesterday were prevented from making audio or video recordings. Only still photography was allowed. No explanation was given. From the outset, the Trump administration has clamped down on disseminating coronavirus information, including requiring federal scientists and health officials to coordinate with Pence on all public appearances and statements related to the outbreak. Michael Halpern, deputy director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, warned, quote, if this censorship and retaliation trend continues, we can expect more gross incompetence in handling the virus's spread, unquote. Pence plans to travel to Olympia, Washington on Thursday to meet with Governor Jay Inslee and health officials about measures to limit the spread of the disease after Inslee declared a state of emergency on February 29th. There have been 39 confirmed cases of coronavirus in Washington state. Clackamas and Washington counties in Oregon have also declared a state of emergency with a total of 3 cases in the state.
The House of Representatives voted 415-2 to pass an $8.3 billion emergency coronavirus response bill. Approval is expected from the Senate and the President. The FDA announced this weekend it would allow certified labs to use their own tests without prior approval. According to Scott Becker of the Association of Public Health Laboratories, quote, there was this very unfortunate challenge in the production process, and it did put us a few weeks behind. Initially, limited testing capacity meant the CDC didn't advise testing sick people unless they had a history of travel to affected countries or contact with a known coronavirus case. And test kits sent to labs around the country had a problem with an ingredient that resulted in delays for those who had actually been tested. Hospitals and health systems across the country are rushing to develop their own coronavirus tests after the government's slow and limited rollout of the flawed test. As of Monday, the FDA was in communication with more than 70 labs and developers interested in using their own tests. There are over 100 confirmed cases in 16 states across the country, though it's likely that number is a vast underestimate. Amid all this, it's helpful to remember that many people with coronavirus experience only minor symptoms, and some of the first patients in the U.S. have already recovered and returned to daily life.
TriMet's Southwest Corridor plan, their most expensive transportation plan, has lowered expectations for the number of daily commuters on the proposed rail line. The original estimate of daily passengers has gone down from 43,000 to 37,500 people, a decrease of nearly 13%. The new line between downtown Portland and Bridgeport Village would cost $2.8 billion. The drop in estimated riders could eliminate one-third of the funding for the project. TriMet attributed the drop in passengers to a projected reduction of 2,000 fewer park and ride spots in TriMet parking lots. This is indicative of a larger national problem with commuters, As many other lines have failed to meet their projected daily ridership numbers for 2020. TriMet does say ridership is now starting to increase again. Still, the political debate goes on, with opponents arguing to abandon investment in TriMet's railways, while supporters advocate to invest more in transit to increase ridership in order to combat climate change. TriMet maintains the importance of the proposed changes to the Southwest Corridor plan.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael got infected last night.
How is a viral infection like a presidential election? We can't do much about either, or the constant media coverage making us sick. They're both indicators of the hubris of our rulers. Virus spreading from overpopulation and the ease of travel. Virus panic spreading much more quickly than the disease itself. As Biden's Super Tuesday ascendancy is the result of the concentration of wealth and how easily money infects voters. The chief vector is fear. Fear of disease and death. Fear of Trump and his many-pronged attack on our freedoms, our planet's survival, while the powerful fear Sanders and having to share their wealth as if hope and a sense of agency are a disease we must be protected from. Yes, the coronavirus has killed several hundred, but no quarantine or vaccine will help the thousands killed each day by bombs in Yemen, by apartheid in Palestine, socioeconomic hopelessness and lack of health care in the U.S. No amount of hand-washing and antibacterial will lessen the damage of four more years of Donnie. I want to soak in infectious optimism, spread the symptoms of political activism and popular power till they go beyond viral to evolutionary. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today in the biggest abortion case to reach the justices in years. The case centers on the constitutionality of a Louisiana law requiring abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. If the law sounds familiar, it's because the Supreme Court struck down a virtually identical law in Texas in 2016. Though this case doesn't directly challenge Roe v. Wade, it could open the door for conservatives to restrict and close clinics, thereby further restricting access to legal abortion across the United States.
While the justices can rule any time, a decision
on June Medical Services v. Russo isn't expected until June.
Legislation that will stop the Trump administration from using confidential therapy notes against immigrant children in detention was introduced in the Senate and House of Representatives on Wednesday. The legislation follows reports from the Washington Post in February that ICE has been regularly using notes from therapy sessions against unaccompanied minors, often without the consent of the therapists and always without the consent of the minors themselves. Mental health organizations immediately demanded a halt to the information sharing, and last week, 41 national organizations signed a joint letter to Congress calling for oversight hearings on the practice. The legislation is one of several efforts underway to protect the confidentiality of young asylum seekers. The bills, sponsored by Representative Grace Napolitano in the House and Senator Jeff Merkley in the Senate, would ban ICE from requesting or using therapy disclosures in detention or deportation proceedings. On Wednesday, 22 senators formally requested an inspector general investigation into the sharing of this confidential information, as well as whether unaccompanied children are being placed in the, quote, least restrictive setting that is in the best interest of the child.
South Dakota's riot boosting bill received a hearing at a special meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee Tuesday night, and committee members voted 6-1 to pass the bill along to the full Senate for floor debate. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Dakota's riot boosting bill got a thorough hearing at a special meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee Tuesday night. After nearly 2 hours of testimony from opponents, committee members still voted 6-1 to pass the bill along to the full Senate for floor debate. The state says the law fixes problems that were deemed unconstitutional in last year's version of the bill. Opponents say it still restricts speech and assembly through intimidation. Victoria Wicks has this report.
Dick Teason is a lobbyist for the South Dakota Sheriff's Association. He says law enforcement officers can use the riot-boosting law as a tool to protect opponents as well as proponents.
Law enforcement has never perceived their part in this play to be one-sided. When we go to one of these, we see our job as the one that is supposed to protect both sides.
But some opponents say they were at Standing Rock protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline, and there they saw government and private security officers intimidate and attack protesters. Now they're afraid the riot-boosting law will offer an even greater threat of arrest and prosecution in South Dakota. One of them is Joy Braun, a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. She says some interactions with law enforcement officers at Standing Rock were friendly and pleasant.
Sometimes they prayed with us. Sometimes they smudged with us. I shook their hand.
But she says not all interactions were positive.
How do I reconcile when there's 28 jersey barriers and 12 feet of razor wire and they're throwing water cannons at us for 6 hours in 28 degree Fahrenheit weather? Who protects us?
Braun asked the senators to uphold the First Amendment as ardently as they uphold the Second. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Utah Senate passed a bill this week which creates a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Task Force. 9 members will include state lawmakers, advocates, tribal citizens, and law enforcement. The group will work with tribes and report findings to the legislature in November. The task force mirrors other efforts in neighboring states of Arizona and New Mexico. The bill now heads to the governor. Lakota writer Charles Trimble, who passed away this week, is being remembered for his contributions to Native American journalism and his work in Indian country as an advocate and leader. His niece, Judy Cornelia, says his professional accomplishments fill volumes, including as an engineer, founder of the American Indian Press Association, and executive director of the National Congress of American Indians. Cornelia says he was a caregiver to his entire family and was like a father to her, generous with his time and wisdom.
He was a complex but simple man who really embodied the fundamental tenets of our oyate, our family, our tribe, our culture. You know, that generosity, the understanding, compassion, commitment to the family instead of, you know, his personal ego. And while he was, you know, respected and honored across the globe, I think the things that he treasured most were the appreciation of his family for the things that he gave us. And when I say family, I don't mean just blood. I mean the Oyate, our tribe, that gained so much from him. He was stellar.
Trimble was born on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. His health had been declining in recent months. He died a little more than a week before his 85th birthday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. military said today that it has carried out an airstrike against Taliban fighters in Helmand Province, Afghanistan. The news follows a withdrawal agreement between the U.S. and Taliban to end the war in Afghanistan 4 days ago. U.S. military spokesperson Colonel Sonny Leggett said his forces were still committed to peace, but blamed continued Taliban attacks on Afghan government troops for the airstrike. The strike on Wednesday was a, quote, defensive action ordered to disrupt a Taliban attack against an Afghan National Security Forces checkpoint. It's been reported that there were 43 attacks against Afghan government forces in the province on Tuesday alone. The withdrawal agreement stipulates that the U.S. must withdraw all 13,000 troops from Afghanistan within 14 months if the Taliban meets their end of the deal, which includes fulfilling security guarantees and fighting terrorism in the region. Soon after the deal was signed on Saturday, the Afghan government said it would refuse to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners, and in response, the Taliban responded that it would resume attacking Afghan forces but refrain from attacking foreign forces. The airstrike today came just hours after President Donald Trump said he had spoken with a Taliban leader who had assured him the Taliban also wanted to stop the violence.
Thank you.
listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Nafisa Fai, a candidate for Washington County Commissioner, District 1. After that, hear News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KABU. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, and then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with a low about 40. Tomorrow will be partly sunny with a high close to 60, but a slight chance of rain. Today in history, Del Close died on this day in 1999 at the age of 64. Del Close was an actor and writer who coached many of the best-known comedians of the late 20th century. He's also known as a premier influence on modern improvisational theater, and following his death, the Upright Citizens Brigade founded the annual Del Close Marathon, 3 days of continuous improvisation by hundreds of New York City performers. Today's quote is from Close. "Beyond the deepest tragedy, there is laughter. Even in the midst of tragedy, there is always the possibility for laughter."
Portland's last pornography theater, the Oregon Theater on Southeast Division, has closed permanently. In the 70s, Portland was known as, quote, the pornography capital of the West Coast. Around this time, the Oregon Theater, showing regular movies after its start as a vaudeville theater in 1925, switched to porn, joining other venues like downtown Star Theater and the Brooklyn neighborhood's Aladdin Theater. The Aladdin was famous for showing the film Deep Throat for over 14 years, but has been a live music and comedy venue since 1993.
Ocean species on the Oregon coast, some of them important for commercial reasons, rely on a plant known as eelgrass. Mike Graybill, a marine scientist in Coos Bay, says the critical plant is threatened by a proposed natural gas terminal in southern Oregon. KABU's Daniel Conway has more on this story.
A natural gas terminal proposed for southern Oregon could endanger a sea plant critical to commercial fishing and ocean habits. Mike Graybill, a marine scientist in Coos Bay, says the forest of eelgrass in the area's tidal waters is crucial habitat for a variety of species, including birds and juvenile crab and salmon. The proposed Jordan Cove export terminal includes plans to excavate 2 acres of eelgrass and replace it elsewhere in the estuary. But Graybill says similar past attempts have not been successful.
It's not certain that the eelgrass that will be impacted by this proposed gas terminal will actually be replaced by the action that the applicant has proposed.
In February, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission voted to delay its decision on permits for the Jordan Cove terminal after Oregon regulators objected to permits for the project, citing its potential harm to the coast. Graybill says eelgrass in Oregon estuaries acts as nurseries for fish, especially herring, which is a crucial forage fish he describes as driving the whole ocean ecosystem. He says the entire Oregon herring population for the coming years is spawning on the coast right now.
Removal of 1 2-acre eelgrass bed could be responsible for the elimination of an entire annual production of herring spawn.
Eelgrass grows rapidly, and so it needs a lot of carbon dioxide, which could make it useful for mitigating climate change. But Graybill notes the plant also is vulnerable to climate change's effects, such as the sea level rise and ocean acidification. He says the 2 acres that could be removed from the Jordan Cove project may not seem like much.
We're talking about 2 acres of the most productive plant community on Earth. So we have to be very careful, and I believe it's important to be very protective of the eelgrass that we have.
For KBOO Evening News, I am Daniel Conway.
Common pharmaceutical drugs can harm important microbes that are food for other organisms all along the food chain. With more on this story, it's Eric Phillips with CurrentCast.
Microorganisms on medicine on this CurrentCast. When we take medication, some of it gets excreted in our waste, and from there, it often ends up in water. John Kelly of Loyola University Chicago says common pharmaceuticals can harm benthic microbes, microorganisms that grow in the sediment at the bottom of rivers.
The microbes are the bottom of the food web in these rivers and streams. And so if the presence of these drugs is decreasing their ability to grow, it could have significant effects on the ecosystem.
He says people can help by not taking medication unless it's truly needed, and to never flush extra pills down the toilet. Instead, look for municipal take-back programs so they can be disposed of properly. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
A week and a half long civil trial has ended with a federal jury awarding Stanley Rice $5.2 million in compensatory and punitive damages. Rice claimed that two police officers tortured him into confessing to a gang rape that occurred in the attic of his home in 1982. He was originally sentenced to 100 years in prison, but in 2013, a judge in Cook County, Illinois, gave Rice a new criminal trial after key witnesses recanted their testimonies. At that point, prosecutors were no longer able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Rice was guilty, and he went free. The following fall, another Cook County judge denied Rice a, quote, certificate of innocence, unquote, as he believed there was plenty of evidence that proved Rice was in fact guilty. Rice's lead attorney said today of the amount awarded by the jury in this case, quote, the number they gave him speaks volumes about whether they believe justice was served.
Hewlett-Packard and processing company AMD will deliver what is expected to be the world's fastest supercomputer in 2023. The computer, dubbed El Capitan, will be a $600 million machine used to run full 3D simulations of nuclear weapon explosions for the U.S. Department of Energy. The DOE has been funding such supercomputers since the 90s and says they are used to ensure its, quote, aging stockpile of thermonuclear weapons will work as advertised, not fizzle or pose unexpected safety risks. Supercomputers are huge systems assembled from hundreds or thousands of computers. El Capitan will take up two tennis courts worth of space and weigh as much as 35 school buses. Stacking its system boards end-to-end would give you a tower three times taller than the real El Capitan cliff in Yosemite National Park. The simulations El Capitan will perform are extraordinarily complex, modeling matter and energy shifting through temperatures as high as the center of the sun.
Rosalind P. Walter died today at the age of 95. She is best known for inspiring the creation of Rosie the Riveter, a song about civilian women employed in the war industry during World War II. Walter grew up in a wealthy Long Island home, but when the United States entered World War II, she chose to join millions of other women in the home front crusade to arm the troops with munitions, warships, and aircraft, according to the New York Times. She was known as a major philanthropist and one of PBS's principal benefactors, and she, quote, cared deeply about the public being informed and felt that public television and media was the best way to accomplish this.
Police in Spain have discovered nearly 1,600 pounds of meth that was shipped in cylinders inside marble blocks from Mexico. The investigation began last August after Spanish police noticed that a company was importing 28-ton marble blocks despite lacking the necessary resources and infrastructure to handle the load. Five people were arrested in connection with the smuggling, and investigators recovered $192,000 in cash, seized assets including 19 properties and 14 vehicles, and froze 7 bank accounts.
This has been the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Daniel Conway. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is not Althea Billings, but that's what it says in front of me. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, and Eric Phillips. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH in Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Nat Moon. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's KBOO Talk Radio, where Linda Olsen Osterlin will be speaking with some organizers from the upcoming event honoring Punjabi freedom fighters. At 9, it's Press Watch, and tomorrow, Greg Palast will be speaking with Teresa Mitchell about the recent voting irregularities in the California primaries and other topics as well. At 9:30, tune in for Fight the Empire. At 10, it's Flashpoints. At 11, catch Between the Covers, the weekly show featuring interviews with locally and nationally known authors. Then at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk with your hosts Patricia Welch, Emma Jackson Ford, and O.B. Hill. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stick around for an interview with Nafisa Fai coming up right now.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today we are speaking with Nafisa Fai, a candidate for Washington County Commissioner District 1. Nafisa is an expert in the field of public health. She helped to found the Pan-African Festival in Oregon. She's also a small business owner on the Portland Business Journal's 40 Under 40. I could go on. But Nafisa, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Althea.
So first, I want to know, what inspired you to run for office?
Good question. I think I would like to say one day I woke up and I wanted to run, but it's been a long journey to run for office. And I've been really passionate about impacting and making change for our community and doing great things. And I think this was the next natural evolution to really be at the decision making at the, the tables where budgets are moved around and community improvements are talked about, and really centering the lived experience, especially people who are in poverty and low income, because poverty is part of my lived experience.
Right. And so you've listed one of your priorities as tackling the affordable housing crisis. What do you think the existing conversation around housing affordability is missing?
You know, there's a lot of great conversations and great plans in progress around tackling affordable housing. I think for me, you know, somebody who lived in low-income housing and now has her own house and owns her own house, I think pathway to home ownership conversation is missing. And I think that's one way for people to move out of poverty and generate wealth. And that's one thing I really want to center on around affordable housing. It's important to have, and also figure out ways we can really level the playing field for everyone.
And do you have examples of, I guess, where we're lacking that right now?
Were we lacking pathway to home ownership?
Sure.
I think a lot of the conversation about affordable housing is centered on building houses and creating more houses, and really it's sort of focused on supply and demand conversation. But really what I'm interested in really focusing on, how do we uplift and lift people out of poverty, and how do we create that pathway to home ownership so that people, yes, we need subsidizing housing, but how do we make sure people are generating wealth and they can really buy their own houses? And that conversation starts with having or realistic expectations about how much houses cost. Because, you know, if you're making minimum wage, you really can't afford $500,000 houses. So if we are focusing on people owning their own house, then we'll really be centering those voices in those people and making sure that the houses are affordable, truly affordable. Because people can't, you know, if you're making minimum wage, you might be able to afford a $200,000 house. But if we're talking $500,000 houses, then it's really not realistic.
Right. And, you know, as you mentioned, it's complex, but also so tied to generating wealth for generations to come.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I'm excited. Like every time we get our house, we had somebody to ask us to sell our house, and excited to see the wealth, you know, how much value our house has. And we've only owned it for, you know, a few years, less than 10 years or so. So I think that's really exciting part, that if we tell those stories, you know, this is could be your pathway out of poverty.
So from a public policy perspective, how do you create that path to home ownership?
Making houses are affordable, making sure that, you know, when we're building houses and structures are going, developments are up and running, I think it's important to make sure that they're going to be affordable to people who can buy them.
Mm-hmm. Factoring that into mm-hmm. the conversation. So tell me about how you would want to address traffic congestion in Washington County.
Yeah. You know, one of the biggest impacts around traffic congestion is working people are spending too much time in traffic. I want to work so people can spend less time on the road and more time with their families. In creating transportation solutions that work for all, I think we need to center those who are not able to afford personal vehicles to get to where they want to go and where they're going. And that includes prioritizing transit and active transportation solutions that help connect people with jobs, schools, shopping, and et cetera. Much of the county is covered by TriMet services area, and I'll support the upcoming Metro measure to expand transit and transportation solutions. Within the urban urban growth boundary, you know, we also need to figure out we also must pay attention to transit solutions for those who live outside the urban growth boundaries. And especially, you know, I say that because the people who are in the outside the urban growth boundaries are not served by TriMet. So we need to really figure out what solutions and how do we expand services to those people too.
Right. And so I want to ask about you now. We've talked a little bit about what your policy positions are. So you've lived in Oregon for 22 years, but you first came to the state as a refugee. How do you think that experience has impacted you and sort of by extension your campaign?
Good question. I want to say, you know, my lived experience really made me be able to do this and made me resilient. Running for a campaign, it's really hard work and a lot of really hard work. And I think being a refugee and having values that are around people in low income and people experiencing poverty really made me the candidate I am, and to run aggressive platform that are very progressive and making sure that, you know, I stay true to centering those voices and those people who are impacted. So that's what I would say my experience as a refugee really made me, like, not to give up and to continue to work hard. I've been working really, I would say I've been campaigning relentlessly and not being tired and yeah.
The can-do spirit. I love it. So you've worked in public health in a few different arenas as a program manager for Upstream Public Health on the Clean Water Services Advisory Commission. You're a member of the Oregon Maternal Mortality and Morbidity Review Committee and also on the board of the dental service nonprofit Dental 3. That's a lot. So what is one issue related to public health that you think doesn't get quite enough attention?
All that makes me also sound like I'm boring, but I'm pretty fun, I want to say. You know, I think one issue, again, as a public health, I think one of the, you know, I feel like Oregon, we have, so the reality in Oregon is that if you wanted to buy a Christmas tree, you have to have a license. But if you wanted to buy a tobacco, you know, you don't have, if you wanted to sell tobacco, you don't have to have a tobacco retail licensing. And I feel like that's one issue that I really want to focus on and continue to carry the torch and make sure that, you know, as a county, we are requiring people to sell, people who want to sell tobacco retail licensing. And those are the some of the issues that are really want to focus on.
And what would be the like the intended impact of having tobacco retailers be licensed?
I think accountability and protection for our youth. You know, we don't know who's selling tobacco right now. If we wanted to, we can sort of guess all the, you know, convenience stores and they are selling, but without having that accountability mechanism is really hard to know who's selling and who are they selling to. So you know, and this makes, you know, this goes in the line having healthy people in healthy communities, really protecting our kids, making sure people are held accountable to sell to people who are in the right age. And it starts with having retail licensing so that people know that they will be held accountable if they sell to youth because they didn't, they were too busy to check, or, you know, they just didn't want to bother, or they didn't know, because sometimes people don't know, even know that you have to be a certain age to buy tobacco. So.
Right, and that changed relatively recently in Oregon.
Yeah.
It's funny to think about that. Well, not that the vape epidemic is over, but just compared to where we are now in terms of talking about epidemics.
Yeah, and that whole vape situation isn't over. It's just not in the news lately, but I think we need to figure out a way to really hold people accountable and make sure that our kids are protected, and we're creating, you know, certain barriers for kids to access and certain accountability mechanisms for people who are selling these products. So I'm excited about that. I worked on when the whole e-cigarette regulations era, and you know that Oregon was the first to, long before the FDA regulated e-cigarettes, we regulated it here.
Oh, wow. I don't think they did know that.
Yeah. There was no age requirements. Oregon made it 18 just before the T21. But and then the FDA a few months later came out and said you have to be 18 to buy electronic cigarettes.
Wow. Okay. So thinking about your experience in public health, how do you think that will translate to the Washington County Commission?
You know, a lot of the commissioners, there's a diverse experience and backgrounds, and I'm excited to bring the public health background to the commission, and I'll be the public health experts on the commission. So I'm excited about that part.
Yeah, and then I'm curious about what your thoughts are about sort of the coronavirus right now and sort of the hype and the confusion and the, you know, cleaned out store shelves.
Well, yeah, one of the Costcos had like a long line to get in. I've never even seen that ever happen, or would I ever would have dreamed that would have been the case.
Right.
But, you know, it's scary, and what we don't know, it's hard to combat that. But I think we need to trust our public health officials and do what they're telling us to do. Wash our hands, stay home if you're, you know, home is the best way to get better. and if you have to, you know, go out, you know, do the protocol, follow the protocols, you know, cover your sneeze and continue to wash your, don't touch your face constantly. And but I'm one of those people that are, I was scared. I was like, oh my gosh, this is happening. What do we do? You know, but I didn't go to shopping,
right,
or I didn't try to buy a whole bunch of stuff. But it's scary times, and it's really, I have my mom here, so I'm worried about that. And we're taking some precautions to make sure she's, you know, when people come in, not shake hands and just wave at each other, you know.
Yeah.
But I trust our health officials, and I think it'll pass.
Yeah, I think people, you know, you feel like you want to do something drastic. And if I do something drastic, then I'll be safe. And the advice being, wash your hands a lot.
Yeah, stay home.
Hand sanitizer doesn't do it.
Yeah.
Don't go to work.
Yeah, don't go to work, or, you know, don't send your kids to school if they're sick. You know, just small things that can protect us. But we're human, and, you know, I think the first thing we want to do is, like, go shopping and stack up. And but my husband was like, do we have any doctor's appointments? Because we're not going any to the doctor. That's the first, when he woke up, he was like, we're not going any doctor's appointment on Monday. And I was like, oh, we don't have any doctor's appointments.
That's probably the opposite of some people who are desperate to get into the doctor to be told they're okay.
But we still would have kept our doctor's appointment, because I don't think we're in any danger, you know, if we follow what we're told.
Right. And so for people who are interested in your campaign, what's the best way for them to get involved?
I have a website, and I have a social media. My website is NafisaForWashingtonCounty.com. And people can sign up to volunteer to door knock with me. They can, you know, host a house party, and, you know, get involved in the campaign to really... or even if they just want to observe to what's like to run for office, or how is the campaign run, they can sign up there. So and I have a Facebook, Nafisa for Washington County, Nafisa 5 for Washington County, on Facebook, which is easily comes up by here.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to impart to the listeners today?
I would say, if you are listening and live in Washington County, vote for me, Nafisa 5 for Washington County, District 1, which is Beaverton, Aloha, Cooper Mountain, and